Namaste Jai Hind, you're watching another edition of the ANI podcast with Smita Prakash. This edition is being filmed in New Delhi on the sidelines of the Raisina Dialogue 2024. The Raisina Dialogue is India's premier multilateral conference where thought leaders, diplomats, politicians from around the world come and share ideas. In this edition, we have combined two podcasts which we filmed here at the Raisina Dialogue. The topic for the first discussion is Dousing the Flames, a new framework against terror, where we try to figure out how can the world create a rational framework that better targets the state sponsors of such non-state terrorists. In the second episode, we go into the third year of the Russia-Ukraine war, where there seems to be an impasse on the battlefield that conceals decisive shifts. The theory of a quick victory on the battlefield and at the negotiating table did not come to fruition in the past 3 years. How have battlefield dynamics changed in this, safe to say, prolonged war? I'll begin with you, Arshad, because you come from a country which is in a state of war right now. So, and the war with non-state actors. So after the October attack, the Hamas attack, would you think or would you term it a global failure that there has been no coherent strategy to contain non-state actors?
Well, I think that Israel right now is in the middle of a multi-front war. We are fighting, Israel is being attacked from seven different arenas, not only Hamas in Gaza, we have Hezbollah in Lebanon, we have the Shia militias in Syria, the Houthis in Yemen, and also the terror threat from the West Bank, mostly by Hamas element. And all of these, the country that's shaking the cradles behind all of this is of course Iran, as part of its strategy, the axis of resistance. And I think that what we see today is definitely a major failure of the world to understand the problem. Look what happened, for example, in the Red Sea. Take example the Houthis example. You know, Iran is using its proxies. And if you look at the Houthis and the relations with Iran, Iran relations to the Houthis is relatively new. It's very opportunistic. You know, the main core of Iran was Syria, was Iraq, not Yemen. And they were investing in Yemen in a way to get an additional outreach in the region. And in many ways for the Iranian, it was like a very modest investments in regional forces that reject the status quo. Well, what the Houthis are now doing, they're trying to definitely shore the military capabilities, the willingness to fight. They're trying to, in many ways, to leverage the negotiation status with Saudi Arabia, increase their position in the eyes of their external patron, which is Iran. But in any case, I don't think there is no cause or grievance that justified the continuation of attack that disrupt the freedom of navigation that affects global supply chain, the global trade. And I think the first thing we need to do is definitely address the radioactive Xi elephant in the room. And by doing this, there's two ways, I believe there's two ways to tackle this twofold framework, which one of them is direct actions against the proxies, for example, with the Houthis. Look what's happening. I think we're still in very defensive mode when it comes to that. Shooting on deserted dunes once in a while, that doesn't really mean taking an action. Every day, Japanese, British-owned ships are being attacked. And it's not even just Israeli, with Israeli connection. They even, nowadays, they lost even the motivation to justify that it's related to Israel. Nowadays, they're just attacking every ships. Every day, we see even Indian cruise ships being, kidnapped, hijacked. So we need to do something about it. But the question is, what are you going to do about it? Are we going to think about a coalition, an organization, a bigger platform that will fight terrorism? Do we have this need at this moment? What we see today, we see that terrorism is affecting each and every one of it. It's not the war in the Middle East, because what the Houthis are doing right now in the Red Sea is affecting. It will affect everybody in the world when it comes to food prices, when it comes to the good prices. Everything will be affected. And if you see that, we have to address also the octopus head, which is Iran. You know, we can't you know, one should not think that just direct action against the, you know, the non-state actor will be enough. We have to do something about the sponsoring states. And Iran is one of them. If we will not do something about it, definitely Iran will continue to challenge the international system and, of course, the West. So
it's a global war which isn't ending, war on terror. Max, I'm going to come to you. You're the author of Rules for Rebels, The Science of Victory in Military History, Study of Terrorism and Insurgency. And what Aushrit was saying was it's not just non-state actors. There is this element has more than that. How do you see a strategy forming globally? Or do you see it happening at all?
So I want to make a comparison between how the world, especially but not limited to the United States, responded to 9/11 compared to the international response to Operation Al-Aqsa Flood, the attack on October 7th. In the immediate aftermath of 9/11, there was tremendous cohesion internationally and within the United States around the very basic idea that terrorism is bad and that the world should do everything possible to counter the terrorists. There were a lot of mistakes made after 9/11, particularly with the Iraq War. There was some overreaction in terms of civil liberties inside of the United States. But the basic premise that terrorism was bad and that we should support the leaders of our countries in order to, you know, destroy this threat was highly prevalent. And I think that I actually took it for granted because I've been appalled by the international response to Operation Al-Aqsa Flood. In the United States, never did I see pro-Al-Qaeda rallies after 9/11. You certainly didn't see them, you know, mobs of thousands of people in the streets with signs of foreign terrorist organizations as designated by the U.S. State Department. You didn't have people calling for intifada, not just around in distant countries, but locally, the global intifada. There is presently incitement inside the United States and many other Western countries like Canada, like Australia, Western European countries in London and Paris, and all of these major cities, you have large numbers of overt terrorist supporters. It is not uncommon to see big posters with Hamas leaders being shown. And so there's the opposite of a international counterterrorism coalition or consensus. What you increasingly see is more visible signs that large segments of these populations, somehow tolerated by the police forces, are advocating for the terrorists. If you go to New York City right now, you're not going to see as many sort of pro-Israel signs as you will see pro-Houthi signs. This is New York City. So I've been very much appalled by the reaction, and I do think it's deeply concerning, not just for the fate of Israel, not just for the fate of the Jewish diaspora, but for the fate of democracies more broadly, that they are so tinged by this kind of radicalization, which only seems to grow. And frankly, the terrorists couldn't hope for a better response.
Sushant, I'm going to come to you. We've spoken about 9/11. We've spoken about the October 2023 attack by non-state actors. But you and I live in a country which has seen that for decades. We've seen that in Kashmir, and we kept talking about it. And this eulogizing terrorists in Western nations, we have seen how Hurriyat pictures were everywhere, how they were fated in Western democracies. They were called for conferences like this one. They were invited, and asked to speak on human rights abuses in Kashmir. And they were the ones who were doing the human rights abuses. The world did not sit up till 26/11 happened. That was, and even after that, Kashmir kept seeing terrorism happen. So this liberal democracy standing up to non-state actors, do you see that happening at all?
No, I don't. In fact, I see Osama bin Laden winning. It's as simple as that. And for me, it was quite shocking, apart from all the demonstrations we've seen in Western capitals, where villains are actually being made into victims. For me, it was shocking to see suddenly that trend start off, that letter of Osama bin Laden to United States, and all the so-called young people, you know, say that Osama was such a great thinker. The guy was a mass murderer, and suddenly you are putting him on some kind of a pedestal. You've got to be completely off your mind to be doing something like this. But again, then when you speak about the Indian experience, I think the problem with this fight on terrorism is there's no clarity on how to fight this. We're talking about non-state actors. These are not non-state actors. These are not para-state actors. These are more than a state. We're talking about the Houthis, for example. Even if the Iranians were to pull out support tomorrow, Houthis have their own agency. What about the international system that everybody, you know, we keep going to conferences and we keep hearing about rules-based order. Nobody ever answers who's going to enforce the rules. And the rules become fungible, that if I don't like somebody, I'm going to ignore, what somebody else is, what a terrorist organization is doing out there. If I like somebody, I'll weigh in. And when you start having these kind of standards, then suddenly, then it's every man for himself. So we haven't been able to forge a kind of a sustained and systematic effort against this menace. Secondly, I don't think we understand it adequately. We don't understand the kind of death cult many of these terrorists belong to. They revel in death. So if supposing you want to take out, and the Houthis are affecting, it is a global problem now, right? It's not limited to a local area. Now, if they're doing what they're doing, and I agree that if you're going to go and bomb a few camel tents, and as George Bush very in one of his moments, he said very lucidly that, look, I'm not going to use a $10 million missile to bomb out a $10 tent. But that's what you're going to be doing with these guys, with many of these guys. Even if you're taking out their batteries, they've got the kind of technologies which are so disruptive that they can hold the entire global economy, or at least a substantial part of it, hostage. What are you going to do about it? How are you going to start enforcing these rules? Yeah, Iran might be one answer, but we haven't really understood how to fight this at an ideological level, at the level of building up narratives, of saying that this is not acceptable. And for example, on the October 7th attacks, it was horrific what happened. And yet, suddenly it is all about what's happening in Gaza, not about what provoked those attacks. And it's that, why are you overreacting? Now, what is an overreaction? At what point of time does a reaction become an overreaction? Nobody adequately explains this, So these are familiar tropes which are used by the so-called left-liberal lobby, which is dominant.
No, it's not just left-liberal. I have seen even diplomats, Indian diplomats also talk
about
this.
What makes you think they're not left-liberal?
Okay. I've seen retired Indian diplomats also say that there should be some restraint. Maybe allow humanitarian aid use channels, and that's how it can become acceptable. But right now, what's happening in Gaza becomes unacceptable. It becomes difficult for even the liberals to support.
So the problem is that, look, it's all okay to talk about a humanitarian aid corridor, but have you thought this through? Who's going to monitor that aid? How is that aid going to be distributed? Is that aid going to go into the hands of the organization against which the fight is taking place? Is it going to them? You keep talking about, and again, you kind of jumble up things when you sit, when you try and equate what Hamas did on October 7th with the Israeli reaction. I don't think there is any evidence as yet that the Israelis are deliberately targeting civilians.
Hmm.
And yet this entire propaganda is, and we don't know where those numbers are coming from, but every five days or so, about a thousand people are added, right?
Yeah.
And this is crazy. Nobody is willing to question the numbers. Nobody is willing to question who's going to monitor things. Nobody is willing to say that, okay, fine, Hamas is the villain out here. It needs to be, you know, held accountable. It needs to be taken down. Why isn't anybody talking about it? And why is, and I'm glad the Indian foreign minister spoke about it the other day.
At the Munich conference.
Yeah. When he said that, look, why is the release of the hostages not an important issue? Why is it not a critical issue?
Mm.
So, you know, it's the way this whole thing has been obfuscated, which for anybody who's been studying terrorism and the way it's been growing, it's very galling because, and frankly speaking, what the Americans did after 9/11, they should have been smarter about what they did. But what we are now seeing is that the global footprint of these organizations has actually spread. It's not got constricted.
Okay.
We might have constricted it in Syria, but then it's expanded throughout the whole of Sahel. We might have limited it in some other quarter, but then it's expanded somewhere else. It's like that balloon which keeps, you know, you press at one end, it blows
balloon
up
and
at another
octopus.
End.
That's what it's coming to. Arshit, I'm going to, yeah.
I'm going to add to what Sushant was mentioning, how the world should handle the and combat terrorism. But I feel like when we use the, you know, the word "word" in this context, like, what are we referring to? The world not necessarily has the interest to fight terrorism. There are a few countries, basically, that use terrorism and crime as their national instrument.
Mm.
So there is no global will for that. There are a few countries in the West that, and also in this part of the world, and India is included in that list, that want to fight this phenomena. What the world needs to do is prioritize international cooperation. We need to enhance intelligence sharing and also enforce some economic and diplomatic measures. And in my eyes, intelligence sharing is the critical one. Because if countries will share intelligence, we'll know more about, we'll be able to track their financing, their training, the logistical support provided by the state sponsor for these non-state actors. And by that, we'll be able to disrupt the terrorist networks and also hold the sponsor accountable. Second thing, which is most important, is the diplomatic pressure. We need to use targeted sanctions, diplomatic sanction, diplomatic isolation to make sure and use all the diplomatic channels to utilize and make sure that to convey the message that there will be a clear and very strict consequences for supporting terrorism. That's what the world needs to do. And unfortunately, if you look what's happening in the war in Gaza, you see, seems like Iran find the ultimate formula to act through its proxies without even paying a price for its behavior. That's what is going on right now. And what we need to do is, I feel like the world needs to, first of all, recognize the threat and be courageous enough to act and do something against it.
Mm-hmm. Max, let me come to you. When we talk about the world coming up with strategies to combat terrorism, one, when you say war, you should know who the enemy is. And my enemy is not necessarily the enemy of, say, the UK. So if you want to do intelligence sharing, for example, against the Hamas, they may not do it because street is dictating terms to the state in many of these countries. So why will they share intelligence? Why will they do economic blockade? Why will they put diplomatic effort when there are street protests by tens of thousands of people in support of Hamas?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think that the truth is Hamas is quite popular and the Jews are not. And this is not just true about Jews in Israel, it's Jews in the diaspora. You know, when
not in India.
No, not in India.
India
is a very rare exception. I'm a huge India fan. I think India is one of the very few countries that actually, rhetoric aside, genuinely prioritizes counterterrorism. India is a very strong ally, both of the United States and of Israel. I think that there are, frankly, a lot of similarities between India and Israel in terms of the industriousness of the people, in terms of also their view towards counterterrorism. So I'm definitely appreciative of India's role in this, including the Modi government. But there really isn't going to be threat sharing, intel sharing in cases where there isn't a consensus around who the terrorists are. And so for Hamas, this is a insurmountable problem. And it was, I guess, a little bit easier after 9/11, where Al-Qaeda was, you know, reviled by many different countries. But increasingly, what you're seeing, because I've drawn this distinction a couple times now between 9/11 and Operation Al-Aqsa Flood, but increasingly, you're actually seeing an overlap in the nature of these threats. Hamas was never considered a major player or even a player, some would argue, within the global jihad. Hamas terrorism operated differently. Hamas itself has prosecuted jihadists within Gaza, and its ideology is somewhat objectionable to Salafists. Because of its support for nationalism, its participation in elections. But after October 7th, Al-Qaeda no longer cared. Numerous Al-Qaeda branches came out within a couple days praising Hamas. And the Hamas agenda has been adopted by these more traditional players within the global jihad. Al-Qaeda now, when it talks about committing attacks, talks about attacking the Jews. There is a greater emphasis now on attacking the Jews out of solidarity with Hamas. And the same is also true of Islamic State. And so when you see mobs of people in the West supporting Hamas, by extension, they are lending support now for the broader global jihad. I view them as friendly with Al-Qaeda and ISIS. And for that reason, Hamas truly is a threat to India, the threat to the West, a true international threat because of its leadership position that it has assumed over the past several months. A defeat, or as close as we can get to that, a huge blow against Hamas in Gaza, a successful operation in Rafah, will not only harm Hamas, it will also harm Al-Qaeda and Islamic State. We should all be rooting for that, but unfortunately, many in the West are not.
Can Sushant, I just add something?
Yeah, sure.
You know, it's very important for people to understand, and this is one of the big failures in the war on these on terrorists, that there is this constant hair splitting, that, you know, the ideology of one group is different from the other. One group belongs to one doctrine, school of doctrine. The other is from another theological stream. You know, they'll have their differences. But if you look at every single terror group, from Morocco to the Moro Islands in Philippines, there is a single continuum in them. They are coming from the same ideological stream. Their minor differences is what the MNCs would call, you know, act local, think global. that's the ideology, basically. That's how they are all operating. So if Hamas has suddenly become the leadership role, if tomorrow you decimate Hamas, some other group will become, will carry out a very audacious action and will become heroes. So the point is that until and unless you're not going to strike at the root from where this is arising, you're not going to get a solution. And there are, look, so for example, if the Saudis were taking action against the Houthis, what did the West do? Today, suddenly everybody is waking up that Houthis are the bad guys, they're a terrorist organization. The poor Saudis and the Emiratis were trying to clean it up. Okay, maybe they botched it up. They didn't clean it up properly. Maybe they didn't have a real battle plan on how to go about it. But the fact is that they were starting to act. And what did the West do? they kind of came down on them like a ton of bricks. All the New York Times and others were publishing story after story about this great humanitarian tragedy. Yes, there was a humanitarian tragedy taking place in Yemen, but it wasn't of the making of the Saudis and the Emiratis, right? And yet they were pilloried. Now suddenly everybody's running for cover because now the Americans want to bomb the Houthis, the Brits want to do it, everybody else wants to do it. And the Saudis and the Emiratis are saying, okay, go
now
ahead,
it's everybody's
be my guest. Yeah, go ahead, do it. Because, you know, when we were trying to clean it up, that time you guys were, you know, dissing us. So there is this basic fundamental problem which is, I think, preventing and which is allowing these guys to actually grow so much bigger. And you name the place, they're there. And it's, you know, spreading at an alarming speed.
Oshit mentioned, I'm going to come to you, but Oshit mentioned going after finances. Now, that is one way of doing it. First was that you don't know who the enemy is. So first you find out who the enemy is. You've said how it can be done. Going after the finances. Now, we've seen what's happened with FATF, right? You take one organization or you take one country, which is terror-supporting country, it goes from gray to pink to lavender to black. It just goes into various colors. That's all we have seen. There is no teeth in FATF. They just don't take the action. So how does one go with the legal aspect to
So FATF is, number one, a somewhat informal organization. Not really, because it has no teeth. It has no enforcing mechanism. But I agree, financing is an extremely important part of cracking down on terrorism. But it's just one of the conditions. It's a necessary condition, but not the only necessary condition. There are a number of other conditions that have to be put in place for it all to be working together. So if you're only going to focus on financing, so for example, for the longest in India, our attitude was that go after the weapons. You know, the weapons are important because that's what causes violence. Financing doesn't matter. Suddenly we woke up to the fact that financing creates a terror ecosystem. We've seen that in Kashmir. Now, the good thing which this current government has started doing is cracking down on financing. That does not mean that they're not going after the weapons. That does not mean they're not going after the organizational structures. That does not mean they're not going after the rest of the ecosystem, you know, the schools and other things that organizations like the Jamaat-e-Islami and others had set up. They're going after all of it, but they're going after the financing as well. And once you start cutting off the financial stream, a lot of things start falling in place. But it all has to be done together. You can't go after one and say, okay, fine, if I do this, the rest will fall in place. So I think, at least in India, to a great extent, that that realism on how to tackle this problem has come, and we still haven't gone the distance. There's still a lot more that we need to do before we get over it, but at least we're starting to get there. Okay. I don't know about the West. I think they're losing the battle.
I want to add something. Sure. Saying, you know, I think one of the problems, he was talking about financing, is the definition, how we would define a state sponsoring terror. So is Qatar is a sponsoring terror state? Because according to their investments in U.S., they're not. So how you would define it, that's the number one rule. You have to understand, is Qatar sponsoring it? Yeah, you should ask.
The U.S. list of state sponsors of terrorism is a complete joke. So the only members are Syria, Iran, and North Korea. The list should obviously be expanded, and Qatar should be the first new country admitted, but not the last.
I agree with you.
The problem isn't a failure to come up with some definition of terrorism. As a professor, my focus is on terrorism. And, you know, if you study terrorism at any other university in the United States or many other countries, you're going to be looking at the same groups, the same terrorists, the same data. We do have a shared understanding of what terrorism is. Governments are just loath to acknowledge who the terrorists are, not because there isn't a definition, but because they don't want to harm themselves geopolitically. But frankly, we would be much better off if governments adopted the same definition as terrorism scholars.
Does Israel feel that it has lost the war of narratives? Is it that the, you know, that they're feeling that the street in UK, that the street in the US, they are determining what the narrative on the Israel-Hamas conflict is?
No, I think Israel is very, proud of its effort to defend its citizens. Mm. We don't care what other people in the streets are thinking. When people are coming to shoot at your family and, you know, kidnapping them from home, I think the people who talk about idealism and stuff, they haven't seen that, you know, close enough.
Yes.
That's what I feel. And I don't think it is a problem. I think we are concerned from the rise of anti-Semitism, which is, I think, the situation right now is the worst since the 30s of the previous century. So we are concerned about that, with the rise of anti-Semitism in the world because of October 7th, yes. What it's, you know, caused. But, you know, every country when you fight a war, it's a barbaric game. We have to understand that. You can't win the narrative. And of course, if you, dealing with an aggressor, play the victim, we are aware. It's not something new for to Israelis. We have a Hasbara group, a public diplomacy group, that are trying to fight this phenomenon in American campuses for the last decade. We are aware of it, but we're fighting with a bigger octopus, I would say, like Qatar funding, Saudi Arabia funding. So those are the things that we are concerned at the moment, how we stop this.
How did India win the war of narratives, if India has won the war of narratives, in dealing with terrorism in Kashmir? Can other countries learn from that? Like, can Israel learn that you need to fight that too, or you just don't need to? First, you need to win on the ground, and then the narratives can follow. How should democracies rethink about fighting terrorism?
Have we won the war of narratives? I don't know. I'm a little confused.
Yes.
I'm a little conflicted on that count. To some
the
extent,
reason that, like, maybe after Article 370, it was like, we're going to be doing this. We're going to be bringing normalcy in Kashmir, and Article 370 is how we're doing away with Article 370 is how we're going to be doing with that. And that, if that meant putting people in their homes, keeping them in lockups for a period of time, not allowing street protests to happen, it didn't matter that the rest of the world said, oh, you've shut down internet. Remember, that became a big story.
So here is the thing. And again, you can't compare situations. Hmm. So yes, when we went ahead and did what we did, frankly, we had the same attitude as Israel had, that we are going to do this regardless of what anybody else says.
Yeah.
Yes, we will engage everybody, but we will press home our point and we'll press it home very, very emphatically, just like Israel is doing. But there's a difference. And one difference is that in the case of Israel, the response from Israel it's a warlike situation, right? And you've seen certain scenes of destruction, you've seen bombardment, you've seen all kinds of violence taking place. And how that plays out as far as the narrative building is concerned is very different from somebody saying, okay, fine, internet is out for 6 months, fine, there's going to be curfew if there's any major law and order problem, we're going to impose a curfew. The civilian casualties or any casualty in Kashmir after the constitutional reforms was virtually nothing.
If
right?
I take you back a little bit, this was televised. This attack by non-state actors, if we say non-state actors, if we call Hamas non-state actors, this was televised and it seemed gruesome. It was gruesome, but it was because it was televised, it came to the homes of everybody around the world. Nobody was untouched by it. But that kind of gruesome attack, that kind of cross-border terrorism did happen for decades on end in Kashmir. We saw that it was not televised.
But Smita, look
tell
at
me
it.
The,
no, 1 second.
Yeah.
Hamas televised it because they knew that the constituency they are addressing would love it.
Hmm.
And they lapped it up. Right.
So would the Lashkar-e-Taiba if they had internet.
Once it kind of turned around and a lot of other people expressed horror, they simply denied it. All the footage in the world has come from Hamas cameras.
Yeah.
Right. No, it's not some CCTV camera. It is all body cams these guys were wearing, and they were live streaming it and they were showing it to the world what they have done. a lot of people lapped it up. Hamas became instantly a global celebrity for the people who adhere to its way of thinking. It became a superpower.
Monks on the dark web, they must have become heroes after
Forget dark web. They became heroes on Twitter and on the name.
There was this paradoxical reaction where...
Sorry, what did you say?
I said in Jordan, you would find a new restaurant called October 7th.
Yeah.
That was all over the
people
news.
celebrated it.
So sorry.
I mean, it's very odd what Hamas did, because Hamas used their GoPro systems to capture the atrocities that they committed. They then returned to Gaza with, 140 hostages or whatever, and were greeted as heroes and passed out candy. And then
by the OGWs.
Just by the local population.
So that they become Gaza. Overground workers.
And then... within just like a couple days, basically denied what they did, even though they had captured it for everybody to see. And to this day, many Hamas supporters have followed this narrative and now deny that many of the atrocities, which we saw just a few months ago, ever happened.
So what's surprising about that? 9/11, they carried out 9/11, right? there's evidence, including tapes of Osama bin Laden celebrating.
Yeah.
But you ask the guys, and you still have 9/11 deniers. You still have people who say, and you go to Pakistan, you will have all kinds of people say, but there were 2,000 Jews who were working in that building. They all were not there that day. So, this kind of nonsense... It's all over the place. So I think there is this huge problem, and the reason, why do you think ISIS was burning alive people and televising it? It's supposed to be popular. I think it's depraved.
No, terrorism. This is exactly what they're doing.
We might call it terrorism, but in that ecosystem.
It's not. It's
the
heroism.
Popular system. It's a very popular thing to do. It's depraved. Of course. Sure. But I think the way they project it, what do you think was making ISIS so popular?
Yeah.
Why was ISIS getting people from, 80 countries making a beeline to join them? They had taken the world back, 1,500 years?
And these tapes and these visuals... will cause this self-radicalization happening in towns and villages across the globe.
In terms of the numbers, Hamas's popularity is way greater than ISIS's ever was. Hamas is even popular among government officials. Hamas is popular in the media. Hamas is popular within higher education. Hamas is popular among kindergarten teachers. It has been normalized to be a Hamas supporter in the way that ISIS never was. The reason why we think ISIS was popular was because it had a big digital footprint, and because of its location, was able to attract a lot of foreign fighters. But because of Gaza's position, where Egypt is no friend of the Muslim Brotherhood, and Gaza, of course, is abutted by Israel, it makes foreign fighters getting in much, much harder. But if Hamas was operating in a country that was more open towards foreign fighters, I wouldn't be surprised if you find a bunch of American professors running there tomorrow.
That leads me to the question, how and when the war on terror will end, if it's going to end somewhere. Yeah. You asked me this earlier, and I think that, it will not end sooner as the West expected it to end after 9/11. I think what we're going to see, the current campaign against terrorism will be nasty, brutish, and long. You see that, and you see that the attacks, the kind of attacks that terrorists will use, they will use sophisticated weapons. We're talking about germs, warfare, radioactive weapon, if not nuclear weapon. So if you ask me, and you say right now, the Muslim Brotherhood, ISIS, they're all growing in numbers. And their connections also with criminal organizations are on the rise. So, you know, I feel like in order to really, like, fight terrorism, we need to fight. I don't know when and how it's going to end, but I know we might fight it with vigor, with dedication. We must do it wisely. You know, Philip Gordon wrote a really nice article for Foreign Affairs in 2007, says when and the war on terror will end. And he said that eventually all war ends. And he said that the factors that driving the international system are so numerous and so fluid, so no political system or conflict can last forever. And we can just look at history, look at the Cold War, you know, how the Cold War ended. It ended not when the U.S. Army occupied the Kremlin. It was when the occupant abandoned the Kremlin. Mm. So when they stopped believing in this ideology. So, of course, we must fight terrorism with all our means to protect our citizens, including military power. But at the same time, the only way to fight this jihadist terror is by, you know, when the ideology that underpins it will lose its appeal. Hmm. That's what this is. Eventually, we must be aware of it. So these people also have.
Let me say two provocative things. One, pushback. The reason why ISIS was not as popular as Hamas is today, and I don't mean to be mean or anything, ISIS was killing Muslim on Muslim, right? Hamas is killing Muslim on Jew. It's a no-brainer, right? So among the guys who love these guys, of course, Hamas will be more popular. But on the other point, you know, the problem why I'm very pessimistic about in this fight on against terrorism is because, frankly, the global system or the international system as we know it is unraveling. It's breaking down. We don't know what it's going to be replaced with. We're still trying to find our feet on it. And even the system as it exists today, it just doesn't have that kind of stomach to fight this fight the way it needs to be fought.
This is why
intellectually or militarily. It's one thing to go and, you know, send a couple of planes and bomb something and come back. That's a microcosm of what you need to do, right? There's so much more that you need to do. So when this international system is going to start unraveling as it is, many of these terror organizations and parastate organizations are actually going to find their space increase.
Okay.
It's not going to reduce. So I am certainly not as optimistic as you seem to be that one day, you know, a new day will dawn and we will see, have seen the end of terrorism.
You know, I want to end this session like a Bollywood movie and hope for hope and hope peace and, right?
Peace
so that peace and goodwill and let's end with the song instead of thinking that 2023 is not going to be a year of peace. It's going to be a year of tumult. 2024 is going to be a year of tumult. 2023 saw action. 2024 is the...
I think you can write off the decade of the 20s, starting from 2020, COVID to what is happening now.
And one had thought that there would be no wars or something. It seems like the never-ending phase of wars.
Keep your fingers crossed. If you pass the 2020s, you might stay alive for longer. Otherwise, you're not going to see the 2030s.
Okay.
There tends to be a lot of pessimism around counterterrorism. Americans think about what happened in Afghanistan, and obviously the Taliban would continue to thrive. Americans think about the intervention in Iraq, which in some ways contributed to more terrorism, actually. But there are historical examples of terrorist groups being just absolutely taken apart. The Islamic State is currently a shadow of what it was. The Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt is much less robust than it used to be. India itself has had previously a much bigger Khalistani terrorism problem than it does now. India has scored some major successes there. In South America, the Shining Path of Peru, nobody talks about them anymore, right?
Yeah.
Look at the foreign terrorist organization list. Go back in history. Many of those groups are no longer around or they're much, much weaker. I think that if Israel is allowed to take its gloves off, pursue its mission in Rafah, give it 3 months do everything that they can to get civilians out of the way, Hamas could, if Israel is allowed to do that, Hamas will never be the same organization.
So let me...
End the problem, does it?
But the first and
it
foremost...
It reduces the Hamas
we need
problem.
To, yeah, first and foremost is that the hostages need to come back home. And at least in that sphere, let's hope that in this year we can see that happen. So on that note, thank you, gentlemen. Thank you very much, Arshad. Hope you have a better impression about New Delhi rather than, tummy upset because of Delhi. Hopefully, when we meet next year at the Raisina Dialogue, we'll have better...
We'll still be alive.
Yeah. We'll still be alive and discuss a better situation.
Better situation.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much for being part of the conversation. May I begin with Sasha? In the Russia-Ukraine war, what we are reading now, of course, we're getting information that it's probably been a stalemate, but then there are conflicting reports that on the battlefront, Russia is making significant gains. In your view, where at what stage is it on the battlefront right now?
I think that the stalemate was used by General Zaluzhny last year in his famous article in The Economist. That's not necessarily what we are seeing on the battlefield. The gains that you describe are not
strategic in nature. Russians have been battling for this little town of Avdiivka since end of last year. They paid tremendous cost of capturing that. Of course, that was one of the important fortified lines that Ukrainians were building back since 2014. But nevertheless, that's a tactical mini-gain. Like, there are some more battles if the Russians want to break through more or less fortified part of Ukrainian defenses. So it may appear as a stalemate. What doesn't make it a stalemate is that Russia's resources that is ready to throw to this war, the manpower, the artillery shells, the other material, armored vehicles and so on, are going up. Russia has problems with that, with manpower, with everything, but they're getting up. On the Ukrainian side, we are having problems with mobilization and with the aid package stock in the US Congress. Some of that is hanging in the limbo. So Russian material advantage is going up, where the advantage on the Ukrainian side is under question. That's not a very sustainable recipe for a stalemate. So if things are not done to help Ukrainians, at some point later this year, we might see Russians pushing harder and being successful with that, despite the colossal losses they're taking.
I'll come to the budget part and I'll come to the political aspect of it later in the podcast. But just to, just about a week ago, President Putin said that Russian troops would push further into Ukraine and build on the success on the battlefield, build on the success that they have achieved on the battlefield, and that one town is what they are probably talking about, which you think is insignificant?
It's not insignificant, but we shouldn't blow it out of proportions. Like, okay. Russians are desperate to present something as a big gain, as a Stalingrad, which it is not. It's not entirely unimportant, but it's not as important as Vladimir Putin wants to present it before he goes to an election where he still wants to present. Like, this war is not tied to the election calendar, but it's still nice to present before you go to the ballot that you are victorious. And this is a small victory, even before capturing all of the Donetsk and Luhansk oblasts, which, according to the Russian constitution, since Russia annexed it in 2022, are part of Russia. He has hell lot to go. Like, there are a lot of fortified areas in Kramatorsk, Slavyansk, and that will be not that easy to capture. Problem is that Russia is building material advantage to do just that, whether they will be successful or not. We don't know, but they are in an okay-ish shape. Good for Ukrainians that they retreated from Avdiivka. Like, we can debate on how much the advantage on losses was good for Ukrainians or for the Russians, but I think that there are a lot of points of concern for the future of Ukrainian military and the capacity to defend their country against Russian aggression. That's not entirely inside Ukraine, but also is tied to what the West will do to support them.
Nico, let me come to you. You've lived in both Russia and Ukraine. How do you see it now? If stalemate is not a term which is valid anymore, The other term which is being used a lot is active defense. Has Ukraine gone into active defense mode, and will that sustain in 2024?
Well, stalemate is an expression Valery Zaluzhny used to say, look, if I do not get the resources I need, then I can only fight this into a stalemate. Mm. It was, I think, an expression he used to rally more help and support for Ukraine. I think many observers of this war are very fast with naming this a stalemate, maybe also because there are very often wrong historic comparisons. Mm-hmm. But the dynamics on the battlefield are very high. And we see big differences to what is happening in the east that Sasha just described, and is what is happening on the south, where Ukraine is still able to put Crimea under pressure, to scare away the Black Sea fleet from Crimea. If we look into 2 years of this war, it's very interesting to me that still there is this narrative, Russia is stronger, Russia is very strong, in the end Russia will win. Yes, it is building military might, but for 2 years, Russia was not achieving any of its military aims. Hmm. Kiev was not captured, Kherson was lost again, Kharkiv is still standing, so Russia did not achieve very much. It is capturing small towns, and I think we should put that into perspective. Whether the dynamics on the battlefield will change is very much depending, I agree with what Sasha said, on what especially the Europeans are ready to find in their stocks and what they are ready to produce for short-term and medium-term help for Ukraine, because much that Ukraine could do depends on long-range precision fire, on artillery ammunition, on air defense. And that's the open question now. Everybody is expressing worries, especially because of the blocked situation in the United States, but so far the worries have not translated into action to help Ukraine more.
I was hoping to get to the budget situation later in the podcast, yeah, but I guess we have to move. What do you see, Teresa, what's happening in the U.S.? Why is the budget stuck on aid?
All right, well, we've seen President Trump, former President Trump, has kind of activated a certain part of the Republican Party to block this. Mm. They got the best deal they could ever imagine in regard to the border, but because Donald Trump wants to run on migration and border issues, even though they gave the Republican Party everything they wanted, they decided to block this. Therefore, the funding for Ukraine is blocked in Congress. And so this is causing a huge problem. But let's face it, it's starting to be the third year of the war. Europe had plenty of time to get their act together. Mm. And they should be supporting more. So we saw at Munich Security Conference, there were some part of this Trumpian Republican part of the party, J.D. Vance, published an op-ed stating that the Europeans really have to pick up more of the slack, that the U.S. has other concerns on the international stage, mostly China. And so ever since Eisenhower, they have been asking Europeans to pick up or to spend burden sharing. And what has happened after 1989 and the fall of the Berlin Wall, many governments in Europe said it was a peace dividend, and they stopped investing so heavily in defense. So there's been a slow deterioration. And then in 2008, with the financial crisis, 16 of the EU member states also decreased defense spending. So it's really an atrocious situation. But even though they've had all this time, they really haven't, you know, they've kind of been giving what's left over in the garage, and they've been sending those things to Ukraine using the EU Peace Fund to get new state-of-the-art armaments for their own countries. So, yes, I know the narrative is that, yes, these are old Soviet equipment that the Ukrainians are familiar with, but there's been a bit of finagling around the sides as well. The Europeans, you know, have hurt their shoulders, patting themselves so much on the back. But at the end of the day, you know, everything has been unprecedented in their narrative, but they really needed to dig in, spend more money. And, you know, this is really, they expected it to end so quickly, and now we're starting year three.
What is the money element that we're talking about? 50 billion, 60 billion? How much is it that's stuck right now?
Well, what the Ukrainians really need more than anything is ammunition. Mm-hmm. And the European defense industry doesn't have these contracts yet. And they did pass an agreement on producing one type of ammunition, 155 centimeter, if I recall correctly. And so that's good. So everyone can come up with the same size. Mm. Because in the EU, every member state is jealous of their own defense industry. in the U.S. manufacture one tank. In Europe, there's over 300, I think, different models. So it's not economies of scale. Everyone wants to defend their own industry. Mm-hmm. And this is something that NATO's pushing. Even now, Ursula von der Leyen wanted to, the president of the European Commission has tried to take a more active role and has tried to make the EU more active in kind of giving contracts to defense companies, and now there's pushback from EU member states to stop doing that because there's a fragmented viewpoint on how to deal with Russia, and they don't like to see the EU commission officials get more power. And Ursula von der Leyen, power goes to where, you know, people grab it, and she's been kind of very active in all of this.
So fragmented opinion about budgets, about what to give Ukraine, and there have been polls which have been done in America, and there are conflicting views about how long to support Ukraine in this war. Is it ethically right, morally right, is something which is different. But the expansionist policies of Putin is also being questioned. Should we support it? Should we not support it? If we don't put in more money, it goes on further. Then there's the China element also, which we'll get into. So tell me, this fragmented view, is it impacting on politicians making these decisions in Europe and in America?
I have limited view, but based on my conversations in Berlin, Brussels, and some other European capitals, here's the thing. Over the course of this war, most people said that, some people said it was President Zelensky that were Ukrainians, but also people in the eastern flank of NATO who said, like, if Putin is not crushed, if Russia is not defeated and humiliated in Ukraine, he will go further and he may attack NATO and so on because he's, you know, imperialist and so on. And behind the closed door, people said, yeah, that's a nice rhetoric, but 2 years of this conflict show that Putin understands that NATO is a serious beast that he cannot really fight. And Russia's capacity is being shredded by Ukrainians in Ukraine. They don't have anything to really challenge NATO going further. And then he never really tried to put pressure on NATO itself. So Article 5 is ironclad. This is a great thing that Finland and Sweden joined the alliance. So it will not happen. Now, the problem is not only capabilities that they have. And then Russia is building up its military, where Europe is still debating on whether you have kind of 10-year contract or not. The problem is that if Russia is on this upward trajectory, if Putin has this darker tunnel view that it's all about NATO, and he needs at some point really defeat it, like he cannot fight it militarily, but if 10 years from now he believes that he's in a position to make an excursion into the Baltic Sea, for example, to go to Kaliningrad, and then nobody will fight, that's what his intelligence will tell him, nobody will die, like in Germany or in France, to fight Lithuania. And then he's like, yeah, I do that. Then it's shown that Article 5 is just a piece of paper. It's just a sentence, you know. And then the Europe security architecture is retooled because German and French leaders will talk to me. It will reduce America's role. And then I basically replay the end of the Cold War and I win. And if he's kind of in his early 80s, standing one leg in the graveyard, he might try to do that because there will be nobody in the room, and that's a crucial element. There will be nobody in the room, as there was nobody in the room before the invasion, to tell Mr. Putin that's a crazy, very risky idea. There will be nobody to push back. That's the risk. It's still very low probability at this point, but very high impact. In order not to arrive in a terrible situation 5-10 years from now, you need to buy an insurance. The problem is that this insurance is not cost-free. The money for this defense and deterrence needs to come from somewhere. When people make an argument that, you know, we just pump money into military procurement, there will be this product line and that tanks and so on, it will generate jobs, nothing bad about this. It will generate some jobs for sure and some numerical GDP growth, but the colossal investment that it will require, the money will need to come from somewhere. So do you have an ability to issue a lot of debt? Questionable since COVID and rounds of quantitative easing. In Germany, the major public policy debate recently has been the debt ceiling. So debt is not really much there. So that means if there is inflation, if there is some recession in Germany this year, that you need to cut the costs from the very expenses that help to generate or keep together the middle class, the fabrics of democracy, healthcare, education, and so on. And these are painful decisions that politicians now increasingly understand. So behind the closed doors in the Munich Security Conference, my experience was that on the stage, there is this rah, 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 we need to support Ukraine to the bitter end. We have challenges, we need to do the right thing. It's high time to stop talking and stop acting, like all of the predictable slogans. In the hallways, when people are kind of after red light of flights drinking coffee, they're like, oh my God, but that's, we must do that. It costs a lot of money. How do we get that? How do we talk to our public about that? And that's the tricky thing, because you try to talk to an eventuality 10 years from now that might materialize and so on. And this is why we all right now, for a considerable number of years, need to go into belt-tightening mode. And on the other hand, there are all of these populists, AfD, Die Linke, Marine Le Pen, who said, like, but why should we do that when we can just negotiate with Putin? He has a point. There is too much of NATO. There is too much of Americans. Like, let's talk. And it's just about Ukraine. So, and they, of course, are making these cheap talking points to win more votes. But that's the risk. So you need to come up with a narrative and intellectual honesty and integrity to talk to the population about the risk. You are arming not to start a war with Russia. You are arming to prevent one. But that's costly and that's long-term, unfortunately.
Interesting. What? I would add to that. Is there resilience? Is there this long-term view, which the 10-year term, the 10-year view?
Well, we are talking about money, but we are not talking about unbelievably freaking high amounts of money. If every European country would spend 0.25% of its GDP on military assistance for Ukraine, we could tip the balance in favor of Ukraine on the battlefield, and the risks you are describing would be much lower. And to me, it's very frustrating talking to European policymakers at this point that it's perfectly understandable and perfectly explainable within seconds that it's much cheaper to beat Russia now in Ukraine than to do all the colossal effort to ensure for a risk that you just described. But unfortunately, like you described with AfD and Bündnis Wagenknecht or Marine Le Pen, in the US, in Europe, in many key countries, we have domestic policy debates that prevent fast decisions on this. And why are they prevent? Yes, of course. I mean, in the US, the whole military assistance issue on Ukraine is not blocked because of Ukraine. It's blocked because some part of the political sphere say, "Look, we have a border issue with Mexico. Mm. Let's solve." So they take the Ukraine issue hostage for a different issue. So it's domestic policy games that are blocking Ukraine help. But what we are missing is leadership. I mean, at Munich Security Conference, President Zelensky of Ukraine, in style and in content, gave the speech a European leader from the European Union or from the NATO part of Europe should have been given. Hmm. I think we have a leadership issue, especially when it comes to the NATO Europeans, where everybody is writing letters to everybody and everybody is asking the others to do more. But what you would have to do is have to step up and put an initiative on the table and actually do something. And one more point, I think that is very important to understand. Putin is an insane dictator living in history books. He started the war to fulfill the historic mission that he feels he has to fulfill now at the age that he is. So the European calculation, we prevent him achieving his war aims. Yes, he did not achieve any war aims. We prevent achieving his war aims and then he will give up. I think it's the wrong approach to a person who is fulfilling a historic mission, because he will not understand or give up. He will just call everybody out and double down and find maybe political ways out of the military crisis he brought himself to. So I think understanding the nature of what Vladimir Putin is today, I think, is also a key for European leaders to come closer to a solution.
If he has the means, Nico, and I think that's the key. So when people are advocating for comprehensive deterrence, of which support of Ukraine, investment into European and transatlantic capabilities, plus sanctions are a strategy to manage the problem till the guy is out. If you can kind of kick him out easily and effortless, and or not effortless, but with some effort that's measurable, and prevent some scenarios that people are concerned about, And I think that on the Team US side, like the escalations using VMD is low probability, very high impact, but the probability is still there in their assessment. And they are concerned about this still, far less concerned than they have been in fall 2022, but still the risk is there. Mm-hmm. So I think that it's more in the territory for now with Team Biden on managing this rather than ultimately resolving. And I know there is debate because there are people who say there is a path to actually solve it, to kick Putin out or defeat him, where with people say, let's wait him out, let's help Ukraine to keep what they have, and so on. And
yeah,
that's...
But I mean, waiting him out if you are the Biden administration. The Biden administration looks into everything now only because of fear, because of elections coming up. Yeah, so they have a few months' time. Putin has all the time in the world. He will be reelected until 2030. So on our side, I would not calculate on waiting Putin out. And dictators get very old these days. Yeah.
What makes you so sure he's going to win the election?
We were talking about the Munich Security Conference and what happened out there. I think it was in the Munich Security Conference because you've watched Russia as well as China. You've studied them. So I just wanted to ask you about, you know, China's position on the Ukraine war. It's been kind of ambivalent, not called it out. And the Chinese foreign minister, I think he recently told his Ukrainian counterpart that Beijing doesn't sell lethal weapons to Russia. And so it's neutral in a sense. I don't know whether China can be neutral in any way. But China says that they are neutral in the Ukrainian conflict. And subsequently, the U.S., there are some people in the U.S. who say that we need to slap sanctions on China because they are supplying weapons to Russia. How do you see this playing out?
Well, it's really fascinating because they tailor their message according to the audience. And it's kind of a Rorschach test whether people think they're neutral or not. People see what they want to see. And there's plenty of examples if people just pay attention. For example, the third highest ranked Chinese official went to the Duma several months ago, and he said on tape for the Russians that we will support you by helping you undermine Western sanctions. Mm-hmm. And so the Russians released this, much to the China's embarrassment, to demonstrate, look, China's supporting us. So Russia does that to the Chinese. And then, you know, there have been many people looking at Chinese exports and going through other countries that they could pretty much outfit an entire Russian army with body armor. This is non-lethal equipment, but there's other things like buying oil that pays for Russia. They, you know, bankrolls the Russian military. Also, drones. There's all sorts of dual-use equipment that the Russians really need, that the Chinese are providing. And so the Chinese themselves are deeply concerned about secondary sanctions. Mm-hmm. But now we see with the 13th suite of sanctions that were just announced yesterday by the EU that Chinese companies will be sanctioned now, and even one Indian company. The names of these companies have not yet been released. They'll be released on the anniversary of the invasion of Ukraine. So this is a big change because there several companies, Chinese companies, have already been discussed, but then because of lobbying within the EU member states who don't want to have their industry, like car industry in China, to be penalized, so they're very wary of doing any sort of sanctions on China, and they've been lobbying against it. But I guess with the death of Navalny, there's new impetus to have these sanctions. So and stricter sanctions. But if you had to have 13 suites of sanctions, it kind of shows that the sanctions don't have such great teeth. Nevertheless, it's kind of important symbolically, and sanctions do take a long time to take effect. So they just keep tightening it and tightening it. But the European economies are in difficulty, so there's not a big appetite to hurt themselves any longer with these types of sanctions. But I think it's important, especially since they're not spending on military defense, so they can actually tighten sanctions a bit more.
You were talking about Biden and the election and domestic issues. Do you think there is that America will take this course of sanctions, or will they? Is they're just not interested because it's an election year? Everything else goes into wait and watch mode.
No, I'm very positive that sanctions against Russia will be turned up now. For one reason, I mean, the sanctions were unprecedented when they took effect immediately after the Russian invasion. But now, after 2 years, many companies have found ways to circumvent the sanctions via third countries. China is not supplying lethal weapons, but at the same time, they are supplying a lot of dual-use goods that help stabilizing in the Russian arms industry and that we find in weapon systems that are used in Ukraine. So then there is need for action when it comes to tightening the sanctions and limiting the ways of circumventing them. And Russia just killed Alexei Navalny. And I think that will bring more impetus to a discussion. I sense that in Germany, but I also sense this in other countries, because it shows again the character of the Russian regime, and it will help making the case for holding the sanctions up and tightening them. The problem in the European Union is that sanctions packages of that scale, they have to be renewed every 6 months. So you have a new discussion every 6 months, and you have maybe single players, because there has to be consensus. So if one out of the 27 is not ready anymore, you have to get them in again. Mm-hmm. That's why we have a permanent discussion about the sanctions, but they have been extended every single time, and they will be extended also in the future.
Yeah. Can I just go ahead. One more point, sure. Not just on the sanctions. China is a big winner from this, because a weakened Russia will actually have to share technologies that Russia never wanted to sell China in the past. So as Russia becomes weaker and more dependent on China, it gives China many more opportunities. The second point I want to make is that this is distracting the U.S. from their major peer competitor, which is China. So what happens in Ukraine takes up American bandwidth, and even what's happening now in the Red Sea also distracts U.S. from their main peer competitor, China. So all of these things are good, and that's how Beijing sees it. So the longer and the more stretched the U.S. is, it's all to China's benefit. So this whole situation has been a win-win for China. And in addition, they probably will get more access to the Arctic. That's always been a big ask and something Russia didn't want to share with China. But China's a tough negotiator, and they're going to just find out how difficult the Russians will discover how difficult China will be and how much they'll kind of push ahead their own agenda.
But isn't China also stretching at the same time? I mean, China wants to take part in Ukraine recovery. China is active in...
When is Ukraine reconstruction happening?
Nobody knows, but China is very active in at least making clear we want to be there. China is active in Central Asia. China has
Africa,
to stay...
everywhere.
Has to stay... I mean, it's not that China is stretching the U.S. It seems to me China is also stretching itself at the moment.
My impression is that it's kind of PR, because... last year, it's not called a peace initiative. Wang Yi introduced it at Munich Security Conference, a 12-point political solution. And the number 12 point was, we want to rebuild Ukraine. They're always business folks. They're like, give us the contracts to help rebuild Ukraine. And so that will also, because Ukraine originally was the anchor on China's Belt and Road Initiative. It was such a key country. They got their first aircraft carrier from Ukraine. PLA, People's Liberation Army military, was trained in Ukraine. They had a lot of technology that the Russians refused to sell them that they managed to buy from Ukraine. So China and Ukraine were very close partners, but that seems to have been
on the
forgotten.
Belt and Road initiative, hasn't that gone into cold storage, or is it still on?
Chinese have kind of changed. I mean, they have a great deal of loss of money. They're not getting as many
finances,
but they're kind of retreading it, and they're more interested in high tech, so their investment strategy has changed a bit. Mm-hmm. But they also have initiated three other programs. So the Global Security Initiative, the GSI, the Global Civilization Initiative, and the Global Defense Initiative, GDI. So they're kind of getting more global. And, you know, these are all Xi Jinping foreign policy initiatives. But it just shows the breadth and
the scale,
the entire
yes, also.
World is included in all of this.
What I wanted to ask you, Sasha, is that what is happening on the battlefront in Russia, Ukraine? Is it going to impact on Asia too? Is, like, for example, is Japan watching? Is Taiwan watching that if America doesn't step up, Europe doesn't step up to help Ukraine, what could happen if China attacks Taiwan? What happens if China could attack or get into an aggressive mode in the Pacific? If they're not going to do that, it could happen there too.
Everybody's watching. I don't think that the link is that mechanical, because you talk to the Chinese and they say, like, yes, the Russians really have demonstrated that the talk about the strength of their military and so on has been inflated, and that they overestimated themselves. Everybody else overestimated the capability of their military, so they were definitely not ready to do that, and that was reckless. But they don't drive the conclusion that, oh, the West has stood up, you know, the mounting sanctions, and they're strangling Russian economy, so we better be well-behaved kids. They say, well, Russians made a mistake, but we will learn from this experience in order not to make a mistake. Mm-hmm. The sacking of the defense minister who was before that head of the armament department of the PLA, the big investigation that's going on in the logistics department, is the way for Xi Jinping to say, Russians stole half of the money that they invested in their military. Let's see what's happening inside the PLA. So they are learning a lot of these lessons in order to fix that. They've been in import substitution long time before the Russians have been there. And they are doing that for a reason, because the U.S. at some point is coming after them, regardless of what Russia does with China, China does with Russia. And that's the thing. So once the U.S. wants China's help on Ukraine and say, like, do something for us, you know, sanction Russia, they say, okay, what do we get from that? Can maybe Huawei go off the sanctions list? Yeah. Can maybe you undo the October 2022 export control requirements and so on? They say, no, that's a separate compartment. That's because you are bad, China. But here, you will get our applause. You know, we will say that you did the right thing. And then Taiwan, on human rights, we will continue to push you. They say, okay, so we helped to destroy our friend Vladimir Putin. God knows what happens in Russia. We lose a very good partner who is becoming increasingly a partner we can dictate terms to, and in return we get applause from the US and more pressure because we are in China. Where is your pressure on India? India is also buying a lot of Russian oil and helping to fill Putin's war chest. Where is the same level of condemnation and criticism when it comes to India from Europe? Oh, India is your democratic friend, part of Quad, that you use in order to contain us. So they're not blind to the fact that a lot of criticism when it comes to support of Russia in this war of aggression is not only about Putin Xi, it's also about China itself. And this is why I think that these two contingencies are not mechanically linked. But what will be important if Russia manages to sustain this war, it's unlikely to achieve its maximalist objectives, capture Kyiv and so on, anytime soon. But if it could continue to put pressure on Ukraine and on NATO and so on, then China will continue to build its force to have the option to take Taiwan. Not necessarily that they will pursue it. If Xi Jinping makes a decision and the U.S. is bogged down there, Russia escalates and does something that requires U.S. attention, that probably will provide a window of opportunities. Okay. This is why we are seeing that countries are arming up, like Japan does, like many others, because they want to protect themselves. A big question how they can be helpful to Taiwan, but definitely they want to be armed properly in order to deter China. Sure.
And Japan is even giving military assistance, macro-financial assistance to a large extent to Ukraine. And Japan is a country out of 32 signing a bilateral security assistance agreement with Ukraine. So Japan is very active here.
Japan likes to see the connection between these two theaters, where some member states don't like to see the Indo-Pacific connection. But Japan is part of the IP4 of NATO, the Indo-Pacific Four, and they're very constructive,
I would say. All of ASEAN is watching it very carefully, I think, including Japan. But all of ASEAN is nervous and watching. And as you said, almost all of the world is watching, because it's impacting on everybody now. It's not restrained to one area. I'm running out of time, so I'll ask a concluding remark, that this war of attrition that we were talking about, some studies are saying that Russia can last it for 3 years, just wait and watch mode. Is that going to happen? Is 3 years a term, time?
Well, Russia has, I think, military plans for roughly that amount of time now.
Okay.
But with the military aim to take first the Donbas, Luhansk and Donetsk Oblast, that is not where a lot of areas are not taken yet. And we already heard earlier the difficulties with heavy fortified Ukrainian positions and so on. And then in the next year, moving further, but there are big cities like Kharkiv that will be very difficult to take from a Russian point of view. If they can, they will use the 3 years to push Russia to the left bank of the Dnipro, to separate Ukraine, because that's the only really major boundary in military geography and topography when you look into Ukraine. But as I said before, that might be the Russian plan, but the Russian plan did not work out from the very first day. Kiev was not taken in 5 days. Russia is continuing the war, from my point of view, to put political pressure on others, and Putin is not hoping for military victory. He is hoping for a political opening. Maybe somebody else is elected somewhere. Maybe he can make a deal with somebody. Maybe there are elections in Germany or in France that make Ukraine assistance difficult. So yes, the war is there for the war's sake, but the solution might be political in Putin's favor. I think that's his bet.
So concluding remark, if magically all the aid comes through from Europe and from the US, can Ukraine push back and go from a defensive mode to an offensive mode and recapture the territories it has lost in 2025? Because 2024 doesn't look like it. Once the aid comes in, once the packages come through, will 2025 see aggression from the Ukrainian side?
Defense.
Yeah, still.
I was thinking about a concluding remark. I just want to have three takeaways here. One is that we haven't talked about it at all, is the nuclear question, because that really kind of made Chancellor Scholz and President Biden very cautious in their approach to Ukraine. So I think that's a big takeaway for Beijing. They are building up their nuclear forces. They already have it, but they're actually building more silos. And they realize that the world can be held hostage once again with nuclear threats. So I think that that's one of the main takeaways. It made the West very, very cautious. If they had moved much quicker in Ukraine, this war would be over by now. But the cautiousness and the slow drip, drip, drip of equipment, you know, 5,000 helmets was the start, and slowly Leopard tanks came in. So I think that that's one of the major things. The other issue is the connection of these two theaters. I mean, who would have dreamt that North Korea is supplying armaments to Russia for its war in Ukraine, and South Korea is providing armaments to more than all of European member states combined to Ukraine. So the ammunition. So the legacy of the Korean War, we still see it alive today, the division between North and South in Ukraine. So these two theaters are connected. And as Europeans are kind of sitting back, watching the show, I think that Asia really understands, countries in Asia understand how important this is, and that as Xi and Putin have said, changes are taking place in the world that we haven't seen in 300 years, and they see this as their chance to puncture the global order and make a big change.
Concluding remarks, a 50-year war we're seeing after Korean, it's continuing, so wars never end, it seems.
Well, I think that it's a disaster that was absolutely unnecessary, that goes against any strategic, objectively defined interests of Russia. Russia was more prosperous and more secure before this war and before 2014 annexation of Crimea. There were other tools that Russia could use to address the perceived threat from the U.S. and so on, which was there, but you have much more cost-effective mechanisms to react to that. We are there, and that's just one domino that falls. I would compare that to kind of 9/11 moment in a way, that after one domino in 9/11, there was the fateful decision to invade Afghanistan, then there was Iraq, then there was all of the collapse of security architecture in the Middle East, the Arab Spring, and so on. So that's something similar. When one domino falls, there are many other elements that fall together. So we are in this...
We haven't seen the end of
We haven't seen the end of that. And it's not only contained... I agree that there is connection between the Asian theater, where there is separate dynamics, and Europe. Look at the Middle East.
Look at the dysfunctionality
of the global governance. If they want to fix the climate crisis, if we want to have a functional UN, we don't have it, because the big boys, the permanent members of the Security Council, don't talk to each other. That will bring more and more trouble, unfortunately.
Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you, Teresa, for being part of this discussion. All the best.
Thank you.
Thank you for watching or listening to this edition of the ANI podcast with Smita Prakash, which has been filmed on the sidelines of the Raisina Dialogue 2024. Thank you for watching or listening. Do like or subscribe on whichever channel you have seen this or heard this. Namaste, Jai Hind.